Blog Talk Radio. When the truth is found to be
I would like to welcome everyone to John Talk Radio. This is your host, John Darlington, and this is September 11th, 2019. My special guest tonight is Wayne Shepherd, and I've known of Wayne longer than I've known him because I heard him play in the 4 O'Clock Balloon several times back in the 60s. And I played that song, Wayne, because I don't know if you guys did that song, but it was something that you could have done. And
Well, I have a big smile on my face, and the smile came on my face as soon as you started playing it, for the simple reason that after we dragged ourselves out of the basement, you know, we were one of those basement bands in Columbus, Ohio, we felt that we were professional enough sounding, even though we didn't have the world's greatest equipment by any means at that point. And then we joined into the competition of the Northland Battle of the Band. And right. Hazel sang that very song by Jefferson Airplane. And I think what happened is because our music, even though obviously we were just starting out, it was just covers, Jefferson Airplane, we played several of theirs. That was the one. And then we played Plastic Fantastic Lover. But Hazel belted out that song, and the kids were in awe. I mean, they're just standing there in the parking lot. And because I think you might remember, at that time, soul was still very big in Columbus, and there wasn't a whole lot of psychedelic rock from the West Coast, you know, going around.
Absolutely.
So that really kind of got us going. And then eventually, after I couldn't tell you how many other times we had a play, then it turned out that we won the Battle of the Bands. And that's what really started us in being able to play in clubs and things like that, whereas previously, since nobody knew us, we had seven people in our group, meaning one was running lights and sound, and, you know, we had a bunch of people in the group. And, you know, you would call them and you would ask them, can we have an audition or something? I said, I'm sorry, we don't know you. I said, well, you know, we would like to play at your place. They, all right, well, we'll pay you $50 for 3 hours. And I said, what are you going to say? Okay. So the fun part came when one of those club owners, after we had really started getting some publicity and all that, he called me and asked if we would play at his club. And I kind of coolly said to him, I said, I'd be glad to, but I need to tell you, for 3 hours, it'll be $300. And that was like big money back then.
Oh,
yeah. He kind of gulped and said, okay, you know. So that was just kind of a fun thing to do. But of course, the big thing that happened eventually, our manager, Johnny Garber, who was a radio DJ in Hocking Valley, he got us booked to play and to open as one of the opening bands for Jimi Hendrix. And
right.
So that's what we got to do. And I guess you would say that was our 15 minutes of fame, so to speak.
That's just incredible. Could you talk about that for a little bit? I know you see, I have the poster up on my Facebook page that has you guys on there with the Dantes. And
oh, yes.
I got, you know, oh yeah. And I know some of those guys are still around and still playing.
Sure.
And
yeah.
Dave Workman and I think he's out. Yeah. Blues guitar player. Very, very good.
Yes.
Talk about, I mean, Wayne, that's something that a lot of us would never be able to experience, something like that. So talk about that. You were at Veterans Memorial. Like, when did you get there? And did you get to meet him and the band? Or was it kind of like you were on and he was on? Or how did that whole thing
work? You know, it was a really interesting experience. Now, Hazel, my wife, was the only one that had the presence of mind to say, I'm bringing my little Polaroid swinger camera. And it was just a cheap little Polaroid camera. And we all said, oh, Hazel, that's just a piece of junk. She said, no, I'm bringing it. So backstage, Jimmy actually stood there and posed for her. And then all three of them stood and posed for her. And Jimmy was playing around with her before she did the photos. He snuck up behind her and tapped her on the opposite shoulder. And she turned around and then turned around, of course, and there he was just messing with her, you know. But
yeah, that's awesome.
The thing I really want to stress is he was an extremely nice person. He was a gentleman. And while they were playing, he had a female companion that was in the wings with us. And she had on this beautiful buckskin long string jacket. And she had walked into the wing, and these Columbus policemen stepped up and said, get out of here. And she said, and she spoke in a British accent. She said, I'm with the Hendrix Entourage. I'm not sure they even knew what entourage meant, to be honest. But she said, I'm with this group. And they said, well, we're sorry, we don't care. And so they started manhandling, pushing her away. And they got to a stairwell, and they basically pushed her down the stairwell. But she caught the railing. She didn't fall. She caught the railing. And being young 20-somethings, we called them, hey, you pigs, leave her alone, you know. And then when she got down to the bottom of the stairs, she said, I have witnesses. And I have your badge numbers, and I will call the British Embassy tomorrow to report you. And as soon as she said that, boy, they became instant little sheep. You know, they backed off and left her alone. So after that was all over, and people were leaving, and I went to the front to get a Pepsi or something for Hazel and I, and as I'm walking back to the auditorium, two policemen come up, and they block my way, and they say, it's time to leave. I said, well, excuse me, sir. I was always polite. I said, my wife is on stage there. We performed here tonight, and we were packing up our equipment, and we would like to leave. And the one guy said, no, you're not going to pack up any equipment. You're leaving. Well, and he was this short little guy, okay? Nothing against stature. But this taller guy comes onto the scene, another policeman, and he says he was listening. And he said, Bob, whatever his name was, he said, no, let him go. Let him go. He's not causing any trouble. So we got our stuff. We left. Then we went back to our drummer, Jack's house, and Jack was rooming with Jamie Lyons at the time, and some people remember Jamie Lyons as with the Music Explosion, and sometimes when people, you see a question mark form on their face, you say, remember this song? Da-da-da-da. da da da.
A little bit of
that,
soul.
Go, oh yeah, yeah, I know that song. So Jamie's song had just gone to number one that day. So this party was taking place at the apartment, and all these people are sitting there and think, well, Jack, you know, rest his soul. I mean, he was really an acid kind of guy almost every day, you know. And he walks in with Hendrix and Noel Redding, and everybody's chin drops to the floor because Hendrix is in his full regalia, you know, silk scarves, you know, hat with bangles, all this other kind of stuff.
Oh, my
and
gosh.
Everybody are just, like, shocked, you know. Well, yep. The sad part about it, though, was that Jamie Lyons, and it was his birthday, too. The sad part about it was that Jamie Lyons, instead of being thrilled, oh, my God, Hendrix is here on my birthday and our song is number one. This is really cool. Well, he was upset.
Oh,
and,
wow.
That's too bad. He missed the moment. You know, he could have – that would have been a nicer – if he had got the meaning of it at the time. Well, okay, so Jimmy's sitting there and all these people are asking him questions. And he very politely says, excuse me, but could we please talk about something else? I get asked these questions all the time. So my little brother, he was 16 at the time, and he was a bass player. He started talking with Hendrix. They started talking a bit. Well, then my wife Hazel saw that he was just kind of like, you know, how do you say it, a captured audience. He was captured there, you know. And so she said, Jimmy, would you like to go upstairs and listen to some music? They're playing records upstairs. And he said, oh, that would be nice. Thank you. So she walks over to the stairs with him. He goes up first. He starts, you know, she stands there as he goes up the stairs, and then she walks back to me. So then he turns around and he looks at Jack, our drummer, and he says, isn't she coming with me? And Jack said, no, man, that's her husband over there. He said, oh, so he turns around. He comes down the stairs. He comes over to me, and he was a little taller than me, and he looks at me and he says, is she your wife? I said, yes. And he just said with a very pleasant tone, take good care of her.
Oh, wow.
And then he turned and he turned around and went up the stairs. And so that was our Hendrix encounter. I don't remember anything more after that, after he went upstairs to listen to records. But that was our whole experience with the Fort Bach Balloon and Jimi Hendrix. And also that poster was for a while on display in the Rock Hall, oh, maybe 6, 7, 8 years ago now, but they rotate their collections. So the last time I was there, that poster wasn't there anymore, but it was really cool because it was in the Jimi Hendrix section at the time, and there was our name, the 4 o'clock balloon. And so we decided
awesome.
We never made it huge. We never made it huge by any means whatsoever, but we wanted a brick in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame sidewalk there, in the whatever you call it, the pavilion area. So we got a 4 o'clock balloon brick in there someplace.
Oh, that's great.
That's pretty much that experience.
Well, that's awesome. And I think, you know, when you were talking about, I think for some of the maybe the younger listeners that might be listening in, and I know a couple of people that I want to listen to this. There was a lot of friction back there. And I was like in the late 60s and the early 70s, it was there was a kind of a situation where if you had long hair and you look like what Jimi Hendrix and you and the band look like, the police were automatically thinking that this was a revolution. You were against the government. You were against the police.
Right.
And it started happening, as you well know. I mean, with like Kent State and all the things started happening. So there was friction there, and you could get pulled over just because of the way you looked. And, you know, that happened to me a couple of times. It's like, you know, we were in bands and had long hair, Wayne, but, you know, they would just want to know what you were doing, where you were going. And that was something that was real back then. And when they were starting to harass Jimmy's girlfriend and all that, because there was kind of a war going on. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, and I think there was racism, too. A friend of ours, now I don't know if this is true or not, and I know there are wonderful, heroic, good policemen out there, and I want people to really hear that because it's true. My father was an auxiliary policeman for a while. He actually was there when JFK's plane landed in Trenton, New Jersey, you know, helping protect him. You know, but I heard that this friend of ours was arrested because he had long hair. He was thrown in a cell, supposedly with a guy who was extremely violent. And the police according to him, he told us they had a smile on his face, on their face rather. And the next morning they came by to see this destroyed hippie, I guess. And instead the other guy was unconscious on the floor. And
oh, wow.
What happened was this hippie guy knew karate because he wanted to protect himself. And
yep.
So this guy was unconscious. So, you know, so, I mean, yeah, there were things back then, you know, as there are today in different pockets, as we know.
Right.
But one time we had these guys that were drunk jump out of a car and come up to us. They were calling our girlfriends off-color names. And I had taken some karate so that I could have some self-confidence. You know, I'd never been a fighter. I didn't like to fight. But I thought, you know what, nobody's going to call my wife these names, and I'm not going to just knuckle under and not defend myself. So I learned I was very confident. And these two guys jumped out of the car, and because what happened was they called the girls' names, and I said, for the first time in my life, I challenged somebody. I said, come back here and say that. And they did. They hopped out. And they were kind of big.
Hmm.
But I went into my karate stance, and I can't say on the radio what I said to them, but it kind of shocked them. And they kind of backed off, and then suddenly the police come, and I'm thinking, oh God, we're dead now. You know, we're the hippies, we're dead now. But what happened is these guys got back in the car, took off, and the police followed them because apparently they had been causing trouble elsewhere, you know, in that area, and the police decided they wanted to crack down on them. And they may have witnessed what was going on and know that we were being accosted, you know, but anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a strange time period.
Yeah, it was, and it's one of those things where I really am glad I lived through it. And there are days I get up, Wayne, where my knees are snapping, and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, I can how old I am. Look how old I am.
Yeah.
And then I'm thinking, I wouldn't trade it for anything because of the great music and the experiences that we've had. And I think that's incredible. My friends and I were from this area, and we went to the Goose Lake Rock Festival. I don't know if you remember that, but it was in 1970.
We had moved to New Jersey by then. Mm-hmm.
It was a year after Woodstock, and there was like 250,000 people there. And it was really cool.
There.
You could look at – you should – oh, you were at Woodstock?
Yeah, Hazel and I were at Woodstock. Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's awesome. You could talk about that for an hour.
We had a pickup truck. It was a Volkswagen pickup truck, but they didn't call it a pickup truck. They called it a transporter, and that's what we used to haul our band equipment around with a tarp over it, and it also had these doors underneath that open and closed like on a bus when you see them putting the luggage in the other side of the bus. So we could carry our equipment in Chuck the Truck, we called him, and that's what we took to Woodstock. And we tried to have a covered wagon kind of thing to sleep, but the rain was so heavy and everything, it collapsed the tarp, and we were just all drenched like so many other people. Yeah.
Did Hazel get any pictures of that?
We both did. I had my little Nikkor Matte SLR, 35mm SLR, and we would trade it off. I'd hand it to her. She'd take some pictures of it. So we've got probably, I would say, 8 really cool-looking black and white photos of that time that I had enlarged to, I think it was 16x20, and I still have them. They're mounted, and they look crisp. You know, they look good.
Oh, that's awesome. Just before we go on to the art part of our conversation,
what was
your favorite act at Woodstock and the music? Who did you enjoy the most?
Well, this is the I guess you'd say the unfortunate thing, because the conditions were so difficult, and they had there was almost no place to go to the bathroom or anything, and it was hard to find anybody that would sell water. Now we came with some supplies, but we had no idea what it was all going to be like. So to be very honest with you, we were not taking drugs. But because of the stimulus of everything that was going on, all we remember really is Richie Havens, Country Joe and the Fish, I think. You know, there were two or three. But what it was is we were so taken by the experience itself. Everywhere you looked, we called it a sea of people. And then when the guy up on stage asked everyone to get a match from someone or a lighter, and then on his cue, everybody lighted. You saw this amphitheater, a hillside, become illumined, and it was just an amazing moment. So I guess, as strange as it may sound, we weren't paying as much attention to the music as we were the experience with people and talking with people. And then we only stayed a day and a half because we were just drenched to the skin, covered with mud, And, you know, we just said, okay, like, we're here, we've done it, but let's go. You know?
Yeah, and I totally understand because I was there, and if you get a chance to Google it and look at Goose Lake, there was a lot of big acts there. Rod Stewart was there. The Stooges were there. There were a lot of really good bands. And I don't remember – I remember a few things, but seriously, you're just involved in this incredible thing that's going on. Mine wasn't nearly as much as Woodstock, but I know exactly what you're talking about because I got in this Facebook group with these people that were there, and they were all talking about things. I didn't remember any of it. But but it was it is cool that you were there. That's awesome.
Yeah, you know, another highlighted moment, which is a very good moment, is that the police had a car that got off the pavement and into the mud, and it was like halfway up the wheel in the mud, and they could not get out of there. A bunch of hippies went over there, surrounded the police car, and on 1, 2, 3 or whatever, they all grunted and lifted. And actually got that police car back on the pavement, in their way of helping the police. And you know, there were no like Altamont with the Rolling Stones. There was no violence that I'm aware of at all at Woodstock. We had three deaths and three births, or something along that line. But
yeah, and I think that's so people need to know that. And how people can love each other and how they honestly can get along. And that's an example. And there were no problems at Goose Lake that I know of. I didn't hear of any, and everybody was really nice to each other. So it was pretty cool.
Yes.
Well, my guest is Wayne Shepherd, and we're going to talk about a lot of things tonight, but I just really wanted to bring up the music part because you have such a great story with that. And it's kind of cool that our lives kind of, we crossed paths. We didn't know each other back then, but I saw you guys play at least three times. And,
I so appreciate, John, I so appreciate your reaching out. You know, I know we spoke once before some years ago, but I really appreciate your reaching out. It's nice to hear from you.
Yeah, it's good to talk to you. Now, one of the things that we want to talk about is that Wayne has, he's an author, he's a screenwriter, he's an artist, an educator, and we talked about the musician. And one of the things that you posted on Facebook not too long ago, Wayne, was this incredible painting by Robert John Wilson. And as I was scrolling through Facebook, I just stopped and I looked at it and I was just captivated by it. Now, I have seen work by folk artists. There's some people around here, around Ohio, that have, and we talked about one artist that that I mentioned, that it's, I guess it's called folk art. Excuse me, but it's unconventional. It's one of those things that, in my opinion, it comes from a really honest place. No, it's not preconceived at all. It's so incredible to see art like that. And when you were able to share the experience of that, and he gave you that art, is that correct? That John gave you that?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And would you like to just
pass on a few years ago? Yeah.
Yeah. If you could tell that story about Robert John Wilson.
He was introduced to me at a time I was in my early 20s, and he was 16. And my friend Dan, who was trying to start what we called back then a preschool, he brought John over to our house and said, you know, we think John has some artistic ability, and we're wondering if you could work with him. And, of course, by then, I actually hadn't even started my teaching job. I wouldn't be starting until 72. But I said, sure, you know, so I went out and I bought supplies for him, you know, sketch pads and pencils and all that. And then we would work from real life. We would set up some objects and we would sit out on this concrete slab where there was a hand pump. You know, we lived in the country and we had just moved into this place that was barely functional. I mean, we had an outhouse for the first year and a half, I think it was, until we finally got into a more livable place. But John would come over and we would draw some things. But it wasn't too long until I realized, well, of course, right off, he had learning disabilities. He was odd in his behavior. And as I found out eventually, his whole family was quite dysfunctional. And his mother seemed like a very pathetic person who almost acted like she was in jail. She was a prisoner of some kind, you know, for emotions or something. And his original dad had left, and then his stepfather dad was there, and he seemed not too much better in terms of his mental development, I guess you'd say. And then he had a brother, Tom, who was really the mischievous one who talked John into doing mischievous things. And we would have these on and off relationships. One time our house got broken into, and we were pretty sure we knew that it was John and his brother, but we really couldn't prove it. And he did a couple other things like that. But over time, we stayed with it. And then things dropped off for about 10 years. And I thought, well, I guess he's not going to call anymore, because he used to call once a week. And he would always start the conversation like this: "Hey, man, how's it going?" That's how he'd always start the conversation, you know, always upbeat. Yep. But then he opened up to me later and said, "Wayne, you don't know what I've been through. I have been on terrible drugs. I have done all these things that were illegal and all that stuff." And I would always be understanding and listen to him and everything. Well, then more towards the end of his time here, he showed me this painting one day, which is actually, it's fair to call it a painting. It's a marker painting. He did it with all colored markers. And I said, "So, John, you know, do you want to tell me about this?" Well, at this point, he had been going to, apostolic church.
Yep.
And it was a very kind of a rigid format there from the things he would tell me. And he couldn't read very well at all, but he started trying to read certain verses in the Bible. And he would kind of proselyte me when we would talk on the phone, and I would listen patiently to him and everything. Well, when he gave me that marker painting, he had written at the top something to the effect, boy, now I'm trying to remember what it was. It just kind of went right out of my head. But he took one of the scriptures, and then I said, "Well, John, what do these shapes represent?" And he said, "They're UFOs." I said, "Oh."
Wow.
And I said, and what do you know about that?" He said, "Well, you know, something to the effect, well, I know they watch over us." I said, "Oh, okay." He had these little scenes that took place in each of them. And one of the scriptures that came to mind was, and I think he said it, but I can't be sure. I thought he said there was a scripture that said, "In my Father's house are many mansions."
Okay.
And so you saw all these little rooms, all these little compartments inside these UFOs. And they were in a cone shape that was rising to the top of the page. And at the top of the page, there was the all-seeing eye looking out at you. And so he had these other little peripheral things going on. And so he gave that to me. And then near the end of his life, he was living in Kissimmee, Florida. And his parents had died. His brother had died. And now he's in a nursing home. And I said to Hazel, we were still living in Ohio at the time, I said, "We really need to go down and see John. You know, he's all alone, whatever." So we went down. And at that time, he asked me, with the help of an aide there, if I would be his power of attorney to take care of his funeral arrangements and all that other stuff. And we said, "Sure, John, we'll do that." And so we had to fill out all these papers and that. But, you know, after that visit with him, we talked on the phone a few more times, and then he passed away. So that's – but he wanted me to have that. He said, "I want you to have this marker painting that I did." So
yeah, I'm actually – all these years. Yeah, I'm looking at it right now, and
– yeah.
It's I was looking at it, Wayne, and I was trying to figure out, you know, what it was. And now you say that they're UFOs, and I can see where, you know, kind of look like that could be flying saucer type things. Now, did he happen to say, like, in one of them, there's a house with a person standing in it, and then there's like words or something in that? Did he happen to say what that meant?
You know, it's like you said, sometimes when these folk artist people do things, it's from a base of innocence and spontaneity. And so he really didn't want to talk about any more than what he told me. And so that's basically all I knew. But, you know, he would always ask me about things, what I believed about God and this and that. And, you know, so we would have those kinds of conversations on and off over the years. That's all I knew about what he intended in the work.
Yeah, well, I just think it's incredible, and I think it's so cool that you have that and that you can keep it going, because I don't know how many pieces of art are just hidden places or lost or people have thrown away that, yes, you know, are so incredible. And what do you think? I mean, you've been an artist and, you know, and taught and an educator. When people are, and I know folks, like my stepson went to Ohio State and has a degree in art. And I know people that are, you know, artists. And my mother was a really good artist, but she could paint things that she could sit and look at, and then she could paint scenes and things like that. What about this kind of stuff that comes from a place that there's no comparison to it? So you can't say, well, it's not really, that doesn't look like a tree, or that doesn't look like a sunset. Where do you think, Wayne, that stuff, that inspiration or creativity comes from? And
well,
what
I,
is...
Well, I can tell you...
Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
I can tell you what I think. I can tell you what I think. I've spoken to some persons that have metaphysical beliefs and things that go beyond our, you know, our common dogmatic religions, and, you know, the dogma that goes with each of those religions, and the fights they have with each other over who's the better religion or who's the only authentic religion, whatever. But I've said that people that take heavy drugs open up the psychic centers of their brain, and if there are any entities out there in the great expanse of things, they can actually have a relationship and be inspired, and one of the popular words today is channeled. They can channel something that has been given to them to share, or something that someone just wanted to express through that person. So that's what I think. I think when people are on LSD, I can say from personal experience, you see things that you absolutely do not see under normal circumstances. Fortunately for Hazel and I, we got out of that very quickly. We just didn't want to be doing that kind of thing anymore. And that's why I said by the time we got to Woodstock, we weren't doing any of that anymore. So that's what I think. That's what I think. I don't know. He may have had an experience I don't know about, or he just might have had that those thoughts impregnated into his mind.
Yeah, I think it's a subject that you can just really go into, because there are you know, there are people that possibly are on different wavelengths, and they're picking up things that you and I aren't picking up, and I'm not quite sure how that happens. Or I think with music it happens.
Yeah.
I think maybe Brian Wilson was somebody, Wayne, that you could talk about that would have that same kind of experience. And he went he went places, and he brought back music that no one could even, I mean, it was like from another place. So
that's really,
I think it's very interesting what your friend, and that he had that expression. Now, did he have any other art, or do you think that was the only one that he
created? You know what, that was the only really disciplined work I saw him complete and save. He had done little sketches and things like that, but things were so messed up in his household. I wouldn't be surprised if his brother threw his stuff away and stuff like that. But that was one he managed to save. And other than little sketches of objects that I saw, that was the only what you would call creative work, where he didn't look at an object or something like that. But I'm sure he probably did others. But you know, it's interesting. This, I'll say this really quick, but in the fall of 1966, I was a freshman at OSU, and I wanted to go home and see my parents and my girlfriend in Trenton, New Jersey, and I didn't have a bunch of money. So I looked at the bulletin board on campus for a carpool to see if I could drive with someone and share expenses. And so on the way to New Jersey, I told these girls, there were three girls and myself, okay, and I told these girls how I'd seen a UFO, or I thought I saw one when I was in eighth grade, standing outside at night waiting for somebody to pick me up for a dance. And they laughed at me. They said, oh, that's a bunch of nonsense, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so now on the way back to Ohio State University, we're in this very flat area where the corn had been harvested, and there was just stubble on the field. And for miles, you saw nothing but flatness. And it was twilight, so it was just dim enough that you couldn't see things absolutely clearly. And then suddenly, you know, two of the girls were asleep, and the one girl that was driving and myself, we were talking. And suddenly this light appeared about a mile ahead of us, And it defied description except to say we ruled out everything. It's not a plane. It's not a helicopter. It's not this. It's not that. So while we're talking, the girls wake up. They say, what are you guys talking about? And we said, well, that light up there, it's just kind of strange. And it was kind of like a bell shape. Well, no sooner had we said that this thing took off away from us. It looked like it went miles and came back in a split second. And it did it three times. And
wow.
At this point, the girls are going, oh, my God, you know, it was a phenomenon we'd never seen. And then the thing arced over to the cornfield. It levitated over, hovered over the cornfield, and we saw a light on the ground from this craft or whatever. And then it was there for just a few moments, and then it shot away at a tremendous rate of speed. Well, we came up to a place, and I can't tell you, it's been too long, but I know Route 70 and 71, I think, connected there.
Yeah, you're probably right where I live right now, Wayne.
Which
is
so
funny.
So anyway, this car pulls up, and as they're pulling up next to us at the stop sign, they're already rolling down their window, and they're saying, hey, you guys, did you see that? Did you see that? We said, yes, we did. You know, we saw it. Well, I was in freshman ROTC at the time, and when I told my commanding officer teacher the next day, he said, oh, no, that was probably just a secret project we're working on at Wright-Patterson. I said, well, you know what? I said, if that's a secret project, we are incredibly advanced at this point. He said, or it could have just been swamp gas. I said, no, it wasn't swamp gas, sir. With all due respect, it was not swamp gas.
Yeah.
So
there you go.
Great
story. Maybe
for some reason I was supposed to meet John, and I was supposed to get his UFO drawing. I don't know. His painting.
You know, yeah, and I actually do think there's some great meaning in that picture. I mean, I look at it, and I see something different. And I'm always looking for something, you know, that's challenging like that. So what I think we'll do, Wayne, is we'll take a music break. We'll come back, and then we'll talk about your screenplay and your book. My guest is Wayne Shepherd. What's a website that people, if they want to see what you're doing or keep up with what you're doing, Wayne, do you have a website they can access?
Yeah, it's www.shepherdpublishing, and that's spelled S-H-E-P-A-R-D, publishing, all run on, you know, one run on two words. What the heck was it? Shepherd? I don't know. I'll have to figure it out. We don't go there that often. I might have to ask my wife. But no, it's Shepherd. Actually, what it is it's simply shepherd.com. Shepherdpublishing.com, that's what it is.
Okay.
I'm sorry, it took a long time. My fevered brain to work here. And then on that site, there's actually a radio interview that the people might find kind of cool with this lady named Dee Perry, who was a wonderful, wonderful talk show host at Cleveland. She just retired a couple of years ago. But she interviewed me about my novel at the time, which I was getting ready to write the screenplay. And she started with a Stevie Wonder song. And so it's really worth listening to on our website, shepherdpublishing.com. And then my wife is a children's book author, so there are her four children's books are on there, and my novel is on there. And you can go to the novel and read the synopsis. You can read background information as much as you want to read. But that was pre screenplay, and the screenplay is much more advanced. Yeah.
Well, we'll talk about that right after this.
Okay.
We're going to play kind of a rare piece of music, Wayne, from Noel Redding. We talked about a little bit before the show, and this is a real treat for the people out there. Noel Redding was the bassist for the Jimi Hendrix Experience. A friend of mine, Keith Dion, who's a musician, sent me this because he played with Noel and was his manager when he toured the U.S. So let's play that, and we'll be right back, and we'll continue our conversation with Wayne.
Thank you. I look forward to hearing you.
All right. Yeah, changing everything yet again. All these different tunes we're doing. That's called West Cork tuning because I live in West Cork in Ireland. Whenever we play there, it's always a G string or the B string. That's close enough. Thank you. outstanding. Try to steal her and the things she be. Thank you. Change up.
And we're back with, isn't that awesome? We're back with
that was fun.
Wayne. Yeah, we're back with Wayne Shepherd, and you can go to shepherdpublishing.com and learn all you need to know. And just great to have Wayne on the show tonight. We've talked about a lot of things. We've talked about music. We've talked about art. But we want to talk about your book. And it's quite an accomplishment for anybody to write a book. I mean, unless somebody has – I would imagine there's a whole path of people that have tried and have put effort into it. But to follow it through, if you could, Wayne, talk to us about it and about your book and – maybe just wet our whistle enough that we would know where to get it and to read it and talk about it a little bit, please.
Sure. Well, because I was in my late 50s at the time I wrote that, I didn't want to go through the whole hassle of sending query letters to publishers only to get rejected again and again and again. So, which is common, even as you know, some of the most famous authors that have ever lived get rejected numerous times before somebody believes in them and they get their book published. And so right up front, what I want to say is no matter what any of us think, we never do this by ourselves. We shouldn't pat ourselves on the back and forget that all the support we've had from people around us My wife was a great encourager, and our friends, and this and that. But then there's that little doubt in the back of your mind. It's like, well, they're my friends, you know. Do they, you know, is criticism, you know, from them, is this really worth something, you know? But anyway, I knew from the start I didn't want to become an author. Really, doing the book was a warm up for doing the screenplay. And I thought, if I can get everything on paper, get my thoughts down, get it organized, whatever, then I'll go on with the screenplay. And so the book was, we published it in 2011, and at the time we had 500 copies, and that's all. And just that 500 copies cost about $10,000 to do.
But
we felt it was worth the investment. I treated them like business cards. If I met people that I thought were really interested, I just handed them a book. And I was so fortunate to have some of the most amazing people in the world endorse my book. Some people might remember Anwar Sadat, who was the, you know, the president of Egypt. Well, his daughter, Camila Anwar Sadat, she became a friend over the years because I was her chauffeur at an intercultural conference at Kent State University, and we became friends, and she endorsed the book. She was an ambassador for peace. And then this woman, Wangari Maathai, the first African woman to win the Nobel Prize in Literature in 2004, I think it was. I went to hear her, and I got to talk with her daughter. And when they found out what I was doing, they supported it. And then, I know it sounds like a fictional story here, but I also met the grandson of Gandhi, and his name was Arun Gandhi, and his wife Sunanda. And we're still in contact with each other. He's 87 years old now, and he still goes to India every year. So we've had some really
incredible, interesting
people that are on board with hoping that this is going to happen. I can't forget my dear, dear friend William Carver Leonard. He is the godson of George Washington Carver, because this book has so much to do in a historical fiction, fantasy, sci-fi way with George Washington Carver. Most people just know him as, oh, wasn't he the guy that did stuff with Peanuts? But he was a far, far deeper person. And I was very intrigued reading about him in the book that was a New York Times bestseller back in the 70s called The Secret Life of Plants. And there was Chapter 9, The Wizard of Tuskegee. And that's what really, really got me going. I was like, wow, this is so cool. I want to write something, you know. So that's how I got started. And my friend Bill Leonard, Bill Carver Leonard, he helped me so much. He was the first black park ranger, maybe even the first ranger, at the George Washington Carver National Monument in near Joplin, Missouri. And he went on to do a lot of civil rights related things and that. Very quiet person, a lovely person. So that's, you know, with the research and all that. Okay, so wrote the novel. Then I started on the screenplay, and I changed the title a little bit. The original novel was Burden of Privilege, The Secret Life of Jeffrey Collins. And then there were so many secret lives out there. But then I had an inspiration. I thought, well, what do I call the screenplay? So the screenplay is called Burden of Privilege, A Love Story for Planet Earth. And it has to do with so many amazing things. I can't even, you know, we'd need an hour, you know, to talk about some of the things. But this is what I like to say. There are things that will be seen and heard in that movie that has never been done before. Never. And yet there's no violence in it. There's no violence. And it is a very uplifting, beautiful movie. And I'll give, you know, a little bit of it real quick. It's about plant sentience, also known as plant intelligence. And so our main character, Jeffrey, has a philodendron plant named Phoenicia. And he has learned to get electrical chemical responses from her when he stimulates her with certain movements or questions or whatever. There's this, like, blah, 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 you know, this little graph thing goes up and down. Well, his friend, Bengali scientist J.C. Bose, he says, I think I can write code for that and get her to talk in English. And he said, wouldn't it be amazing if this plant has a kind of intelligence to reveal the wisdom of the universe? So that's what happens. And, of course, there are these dark forces that don't want mankind to be enlightened in any way beyond what they would like to manipulate and control people with, how they, you know, get on to us by our emotions and that kind of thing. So that's pretty much a summary of the screenplay.
So how much of your time and energy did you put into this? Because it sounds like it would take so much of that of a person. Yeah. And then how does that feel, Wayne, to get that out there? I mean, do you revisit it? Have you done any tweaking to it? Or you just kind of leave it the way it is? I mean, how does that feel to have it out there?
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked that. And I know we only have a couple minutes left. But my wife, Hazel, is wonderful with words. She's a wonderful editor. She knows how to get rid of all the gobbledygook and get it down to essence. And so what had been a 143-page screenplay, and you have to remember, each page is a minute on screen, okay? She got it down from 143 to 128. And I kind of bit my knuckles of a couple scenes that she got rid of, but I saved them such that should a producer say, oh, no, let's throw that in too, they'll still be there. But she did a wonderful editing job, and yeah, we tweak little parts here and there, and I've even written notes that are referred to as a shooting script. When you first write a script with dialogue and all that, that's called a spec script. So the shooting script is usually not even done by the author, the screenwriter, the production people do that. But I felt that if I had notes, and you're hearing more and more now, people are consulting with authors more than they have in the past. They want to, as they say, pick the author's brain. Well, what did you mean by that? Or this, you know. So that's good, and I'm hoping that that's what will happen when it gets picked up, is that they'll want to hear more from me.
Well, it's so good, Wayne, to have something out there that will stimulate people and is a positive thing. I mean, I think that some of the people that you've mentioned are people of peace, and George Washington Carver, and people that, you know, sometimes they don't get their credit. And I think it's so cool that you're putting that out there.
I would like people to go online and Google and put quotes by George Washington Carver, George Washington Carver quotes, and they will see what I call him, a Gandhi-like genius in so many ways, a very humble man, but some of the things he says are profound. So I would recommend people go on and find some of his sayings.
Yeah, I will definitely do that. I love reading. I want to read your book, so I've got a couple right now that I'm working on. People will send them to me, and I'm reading a couple right now, but I definitely have – well, yours will be on the list, so I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, and I'll throw this in real quick. We only have a very limited number of hard copies left. We're not going to sell any of those. We want to keep them for future events in case there's a reprint or whatever. But you can go online to Amazon and you can get it as an ebook. You know, Burden of Privilege, The Secret Life of Jeffrey Collins. That's the novel. So that still can be purchased online. And it's
okay. That's cool. Now, I really appreciate talking to you tonight, Wayne. I just hope the best for you, and it's so great, and I want to do this again sometime. Is there anything you'd like to say to the audience out there, maybe I missed, or anything you would like to mention?
Well, no, I mean, I'm hoping that we can all celebrate the reality of this becoming a movie, because I think it'll be a very, very uplifting experience. I think a viewer should leave a movie theater feeling like they were given something that's a precious gift, rather than having their senses just thrown all over the place with exploding buildings and that kind of stuff. And they take your money, they razzle that to you, and then say, okay, we're done, go. So I'm just hoping that this is something, I believe it would give everybody something precious to take with them for many, many years to come.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. Thank you so much, Wayne.
Thank you so much. Very much appreciated.
We wish you the best, and everybody at shepherdpublishing.com. Thank you so much for supporting this show, the people out there that have supported this since 2008. We really appreciate that. And Wayne, have a great evening, and everybody
you
just
too.
Love each other, and we'll talk to you
Thank
later.
Thank you, and all the listeners.
Yeah. caca and world in two. Throw your pride to one side, it's the least you can do. Beatniks and politics, nothing is new. A yardstick for lunatics, one point of view.
If you found your place at last, then you need not use the looking glass.